Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Jürgen Meltzer, author of the book Wings for the Rising Sun, a transnational history of Japanese aviation. Jürgen, welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, Mark, and thank you very much. And also thank you very much to the New Books Network for inviting me to this interview.
Well, you're very welcome, but the pleasure is ours. We always enjoy featuring books that are, you know, good academic studies, especially one of the quality of your work.
Oh, thank you very much.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, my name, obviously, is Jürgen Meltzer. I'm a professor at Yamanashi Gakuin University in Japan. And as you already might have guessed from my accent, I come from Germany. I grew up in a small town near Stuttgart in the south of Germany. And I would say my research and my new book are somehow closely connected to my biography. So please allow me to talk a little bit about my previous career.
Please do.
Since I was a teenager, I loved flying. And then when I was 16, I joined the local glider flying club, where I learned how to fly with gliders. At the age of 25, I joined the German airline Lufthansa to become an airline pilot. And after several years of flying short-range jets within Europe, I changed to the jumbo jet. This was very nice because with this aircraft, I was flying to many places all around the world, including Japan. That's actually where my deep interest in Japan started. Then in the year 2000, I had a sports accident and I could not fly anymore. I decided to go back to university and began studying Japanese language and Japanese history, first in London and then in the United States at Harvard and Princeton. Well, that's how I became a historian of modern Japan. And now at Yamanashi Gakuin, I'm teaching courses on Japanese history, the history of technology in Japan, and also courses on the history of Japan's international relations.
Your biography, I find to be very helpful to understand because it really speaks to the degree of depth that you bring to the book, because it's, you know, so many books you know, can be histories of a subject, but you also bring to it that experience as a pilot. And that comes through in all sorts of ways in terms of your understanding of the material and your approach to the subject. I learned a lot from it that really helped me to realize that this was a book written by a historian who knew about flying and not just a historian who spent all their time, you know, going through the archives and working with the documents.
Yeah, thank you for your kind words. And well, I consider myself in a way fortunate that I can combine the knowledge that I gained before joining academia with what I learned afterwards. And I'm happy to hear that this somehow is reflected in the book.
There's another aspect of your biography that I think is also reflected in the book, and that is your approach to the subject. Why exactly did you decide to embrace a transnational history of Japanese aviation? And what do you mean by that phrase?
Okay, so transnational aspect is really important. And well, people, there is a vague agreement that transnational circulation means the movement of objects, people, and ideas. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the development of Japanese aviation from the early moments on. Objects, that means aircraft and machinery. People, that means pilots, engineers, and trainers, and new ideas about, well, aerodynamics, but also about aerial warfare, all crossed the border and made this quite a transnational movement.
That was one of the things I thought was very fascinating, was that notion of technology transfer that you talk about. And yet at the same time, you make it very clear in the book, you're pushing back against the assumption that so many people, especially Americans, had during this period, that the Japanese were simply copiers, that they simply mimicked technology, often in an inferior way. And as you explain, the real story is so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, that's true. And in a way, I want to pay respect, especially to the Japanese engineers, because just as you said, often there was the stereotype, well, they are just copying. But that's actually not what happened. I try to show that throughout the periods that I am describing, these engineers rapidly absorbed new technologies, but in many cases, you might even say in most cases, they elevated into a totally original new level that was in many ways higher than what initially came to Japan. So it was not only about copying, it was a fast learning process that in the end resulted in considerable improvement and own original inventions.
I was wondering if you could start us off in the book by talking about the early history of Japanese aviation, sort of the prehistory of heavier-than-air flight. Could you explain how Japan got into aviation and what that reveals about what the light that it sheds into sort of the overall process you describe in your book?
Yeah, so my book starts with the real first steps to get airborne. And well, this was in the year 1877 when the Japanese launched their first manned balloon. And you could say, so a balloon, so what? But I'm trying to make a point that already at that time, Japanese aviation combined public air-mindedness with aerial armament and intense nationalism. This process can be followed throughout the rest of my story. So when this balloon went up, public enthusiasm reached such a height that some commentators were talking about a balloon fever spreading in Japan. I then follow the balloon story to the Russo-Japanese War 1904-1905 that marked the beginning of aerial warfare when Japanese reconnaissance balloons played a central role in the surrender of Port Arthur. In my first chapter, I also suggest that anxiety over Japan's relative backwardness was a major motive for the further advancement of Western aviation. So the Japanese looked at the fast progress of Western aviation, and the military then decided to send two officers to France and to Germany for flight training. And this had some effect because then in December 1910, the Japanese army carefully orchestrated Japan's first motorized flight at Tokyo's Yoyogi Parade Ground. By the way, you can still find a commemorative plaque there. And this event was the big thing. It went down as a landmark in Japanese history, and you might say also as a defining moment of national pride. So what happened? An enormous crowd celebrated Japan's first pilots as national heroes, and the press praised them for having secured Japan's membership in the exclusive club of airfaring nations. And I'm trying to make a point that already then airplanes were no more simple means of transport, but they also were highly efficient propaganda vehicles that spurred popular enthusiasm and air-minded patriotism.
That was one of the things that I think runs throughout your book, which is the degree to which aviation really does become this symbol of modernity for the Japanese. It's an example that they are not a backwards nation like, say, China, that they are, in fact, at the leading edge. And yes, they're initially having to rely heavily upon the West. As you explained, they're going to France, they're going to Germany, but they're very keen on demonstrating that they're keeping up, that they're doing the best to have that modern air arm as part of their identity.
Yes, that's right. It was, as you rightly said, a symbol of modernism, and it also helped the military to unite the public behind the aviation project. That's why right from the beginning, there was no secrecy about it. It was just the contrary. The military wanted to disseminate what I call air-mindedness among the Japanese people, to foster this nationalism. And of course, aviation is expensive, to get support for enough funding for the aviation project.
And that was something else I thought was very fascinating in your book, was that they weren't simply looking to the West for technology. They, as you explained, they also looked to the West for inspiration as to how to engage the public. And I thought your examination of, for example, how they looked at how the Germans were responding to flight early on, how this was coming across in the attachés and the other visitors who were traveling to Europe to investigate aviation, how they're responding to this, and they're saying, this is an idea we should do. We should do subscriptions. We should do public shows, because it's a way of getting that support necessary to get the necessary funding.
Yes, that's right. So this is especially in the second chapter. I'm looking what I call the French decade. And I'm arguing that France initially had enormous impact on the early build-up of Japan's air power. And one reason is that before World War I, France, and not the US for that matter, France was leading world aviation. So the Japanese, they look to France and they invite French experts to promote Japanese aviation. And there was the so-called French aeronautical mission to Japan. This was in late 1918. The Japanese invited those French experts to do flight instruction, also to set up the license production of French aircraft and aero engines. And also the French were promoting a new air strategy. So this would be the non-material part of technology transfer that was welcomed by the modernizers of the Japanese army. And as it turned out, the hopes of the French to establish an aviation monopoly in Japan didn't materialize because during the aviation mission, there were several accidents. The Japanese were often not quite happy with the aircraft, which some of them were obsolete or even damaged. So they were at the end of the French decade, this would be the mid-1920s, some doubts about the benefits to further engage with French technology. And that, interestingly, opens the door for the German experts to come in.
Now, did the that issue with the French technology, the planes that they were acquiring, did that reflect a desire to hold the Japanese back? Did that reflect a sort of a French disinterest in really cementing themselves in Japan, or was it just a series of accidents because the French didn't quite invest themselves as seriously in as they should have in developing Japanese aviation?
That's exactly the perfect question, because the French idea was to keep the Japanese in a dependent state. So they could not catch up with the fast advance of aviation, and they always would buy, French aircraft. Initially, these aircraft would be the surplus aircraft. Nobody wanted to buy them, left over from World War I. And the French thought if they can establish this monopoly, then, the Japanese become like a regular customer. But again, this did not happen. We said it at the beginning of our conversation. The Japanese showed a remarkable ability to absorb the technology and gain technological independence. This was one of the big aims of not only of the aviation industry, but also of the military. One of the reasons being that during World War I, the Japanese became painfully aware how much they depend on technological imports from outside that they were denied in large parts during the war. So this technological autonomy was a top priority on the list of the military and also of the industry.
Now, as you have already said, the Japanese move away from the French by the mid-1920s because they're not satisfied with what they're getting from the French. Now, there are other options that they could turn to. There's the British, there's the United States, but they turn to the Germans. And on the surface, it seems that the Germans were a very unlikely source to turn to, given the fact that they had lost the war, that there were restrictions in place on their ability to export technology, to develop an air industry. Why do the Japanese turn to the Germans, and what benefits do they get from that relationship?
Yeah, again, it's a very interesting topic, and you're very right. If we look at it on the surface, why should they turn to the Germans? Keeping in mind that they have been the enemies of the Japanese during World War I, but it's exactly World War I, or let's say the consequences of World War I, that brought the Germans to Japan. And the main consequence, of course, would be the Versailles Treaty. I'm making an argument that this treaty unintentionally promoted German aviation technology to Japan, because the treaty allowed Japanese observers unprecedented access to Germany's aircraft makers and their products. So they could visit the factories, and they could visit the aircraft hangars in Germany as part of the Allied inspection team, and they were quite fascinating. Also, another fallout of World War I were new concepts, just such as air superiority, strategic bombing, and air defense. And this all had the effects that the modernizers in the Japanese army came up with a plan of national mobilization that included the build-up of a large-scale national aviation industry. And also, it's quite important, they also moved towards a more offensive air power doctrine. And because they were so much fascinated by the Germans, they invited the German engineers.
And that gets to what for me was one of the most fascinating parts of your book, which was your description of Ernst Haeckel. Because you have here, an excellent example of what the French were trying to do earlier, which was to lock the Japanese into a relationship of dependency. And yet you explain in there not only that effort, but how the Japanese are able to break away from it. Could you perhaps elaborate upon that just a little bit as to what Haeckel was trying to do, and even at that late stage in terms of the history that you covered in this book?
Yes, so Ernst Haeckel was one of four major aircraft makers that had a decisive influence on Japan. Now, Haeckel was different from the other aircraft makers I'm dealing with, and I will talk about them in a short moment. Haeckel mainly focused on the design of new aircraft. He was not so much into exporting production technology. he built new aircraft. The Japanese, they liked them. And once he established a license contract, already he came up with the next aircraft. It was a bit like I said before, the idea of the Frenchman. Well, we, in this case Heinkel, we develop faster than our customers can follow to keep them in a permanent state of dependency. It didn't work in the end because by the early 1930s, the Japanese have understood Heinkel's design philosophy so well that step by step, in the end, they didn't need him anymore. So I would say Heinkel was a shrewd businessman who was not so much concerned with the overall development of Japanese aviation. He just wanted to do business. Well, nothing bad about it. But I contrast him with, another aircraft maker. This was Dornier. Dornier teamed up with Kawasaki. And Dornier did not only sell aircraft, but also, and that was something the Japanese cleverly insisted on, included in his license contract the training of Japanese engineers. And there is one person, I will give him quite a credit. It's Richard Vogt from Dornier, who really cared about transmitting his engineering knowledge to the Japanese engineers. So he trained them on the drawing board, and the most important technology that the Japanese at that time wanted to get was the technology of building all metal aircraft. For this, Dornier was well known, and Richard Vogt taught the engineers this new technology with the ultimate aim, and this was against the will of his superior, to have the Japanese engineers reach a stage where they can come up with their own original design. So this was just the opposite strategy from Heinkel. Heinkel aimed for permanent dependency, and Richard Vogt aimed for Japanese engineers becoming independent, autonomous, and no more requiring the import of aircraft and not even requiring the import of, new technological knowledge.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There's another aspect of the Dornier relationship that I thought was interesting, because you're not just talking about air manufacturing generally and aircraft technology. With that one, you're talking more specifically about a particular type of airplane, which is the seaplane. And that what I thought was interesting, because it spoke to Japan's very special interest in that technology and what they were thinking about doing with it. So how did that relationship with Dornier and the seaplanes, why was that of particular interest to the Japanese?
Well, let's say the particular interest in seaplanes for the Japanese, again, you could say, was an outcome of World War I. According to the Versailles Treaty, the Japanese got a number of islands south of the equator that have been German-occupied territory. Now the Japanese get them, and that's where the seaplanes become tremendously important. According to the treaty, the Japanese were not allowed to build any fortification on those islands. So seaplanes were the ideal means to establish kind of military control of the area. And why was that important? And that brings it into a wider international aspect. It was important because these islands were along the shipping routes between Hawaii and the Philippines. So already at that time, the Japanese, they set up war games with the US as a potential enemy. And in these war games, it became obvious that these islands were of immense strategic importance and that seaplanes would be the ideal technology, as I said already, to establish military control of the area. And that's why the Japanese welcomed the new seaplane technology, of course.
And yet, as you then go on to explain, it was not just seaplane technology that Japan embraces. They also embrace naval air power in terms of aircraft carriers. I was wondering if you could take us back a bit and explain that how the Japanese became interested in carrier technology, and to whom did they turn for to develop that expertise?
Yeah, thank you for this question. So this brings in now the third nation. This would be, of course, be Britain. And one reason why the Navy turned to the British is, well, it's tradition. This was already the case in the Meiji period. And the reason, again, of course, is very simple. Well, Britain was the leading seafaring nation. And Britain also was the leader of naval aviation. So what happened already during the war, Japanese observers went to Britain. They saw how the British entertaining the idea of an aircraft carrier. And then in 1921, one of the greatest exploits of the Japanese Navy was the invitation of the so-called British Aviation Mission to Japan. This is quite an interesting story, and there's a colorful character. It's William Forbes Semple, a Scottish nobleman educated at Eton. He was the leader of the mission, and the mission brought more than 100 aircraft and a number of mission members that trained the Japanese. Now it's the Navy's pilots in aerial combat, reconnaissance, and air attacks. And I'm trying to make a point in the chapter about technology transfer from Britain that 1923, this was the peak of technology transfer from Britain, because in this year, Japan carried out, its first carrier deck landing. This was a Japanese aircraft designed by British engineers that landed on Japan's first aircraft carrier that itself was modeled on the British carrier Furious. Again, this was widely celebrated. The press was there. And again, there was this feeling, now we joined the exclusive club of the small number of nations who have their own aircraft carriers.
There is actually another member of the mission whose story I found so fascinating, and that was Frederick Rutland, because I thought within his experience, it spoke to something about how, I guess the word I'm going for is, because I can't think of a better one, is seductive, the Japanese are, in the sense that you're talking about a person who's a part of the Semple mission, who is British, and yet, as you explained, he ends up becoming, in effect, an agent for Japan up through the Second World War.
That's right. So there was seduction. I think it's a good word that, it became quite tempting for some of the British to overstep the boundaries. And it's difficult to judge if this was only for monetary profit or maybe they became Japanophiles. Well, that's some kind of speculation. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about British spies, even more, shocking to the British Air Ministry was that even Semple himself, remember the nobleman, the leader of the British aviation mission, he spied for the Japanese in Britain. And this is something also quite interesting, that had been kept quite secret only a few years ago. The British archives opened up on this matter, and well, it made it even into frontline news that a British nobleman turned into a spy for the Japanese.
Hmm. Now, this takes us to the part at which you start to see American technology becoming more interesting to the Japanese. I was wondering if you could perhaps talk about why they decided to start looking at American technology and the relationship that emerges between the United States and Japan in terms of technology transfer during the interwar period.
Yes, so now what is it? Would be country number four, the United States. One could ask, why did the influence of the United States made itself felt rather late? And one of the reasons is that U.S. military aviation after World War I was not really, how should I say, interesting for the Japanese. What really interested them was progress in civil aviation. For several reasons, there's the Guggenheim Fund and, the politics promoting civil aviation in the United States. U.S. airliners, became harbingers of the latest technology. I'm talking, for instance, about retractable landing gears or highly efficient aero engines. And I'm even devoting quite a section to the so-called variable pitch propeller, which became an essential device to deliver more engine power. So what the Japanese did, they went to the civilian U.S. aircraft makers, made negotiation for license production. And one thing the Japanese also were really fascinated was American progress in mass production. And the reason for this, quite obviously, is that the American aircraft makers learned a lot from the automobile industry, and they were amazed how many aspects of producing an automobile could be used for making aircraft fast and in large numbers. And that was something that utterly impressed the Japanese industrialists. So it was not only about aviation technology, it was also about production technology, and that's where machine tools came in. So the Japanese, I call it, they really developed a buying frenzy for American machine tools, because this was the perfect device to build a lot of aircraft in a very short time.
You have a great description of it, but I also thought that you make a very nice use of illustrations in your book. And there's one, it's on page 214, and it's where you put side by side a plan for the Pratt and Whitney factory in Connecticut, and you show it next to the a plan for Mitsubishi's number 4 engine works in Nagoya, and you point out how the similarities are right there. And this becomes so well known that, as you explain later in the book, when the United States is during the war, when they're preparing to bomb Japan, what they do as part of the preparations is they go to American factories and look at their layout, and then they use this to plan on how they're going to bomb the Japanese equivalents, because they figure they're virtually one and the same.
That's right. So my guess is, the picture of the Mitsubishi factory I found in the USBS, the United States Strategic Bombing Surveys. And my guess is maybe it was quite to the astonishment of the Americans at that time, to what extent the Japanese, they copied, and I have to say further developed American production technology, not only by using American-style machine tools, but also by using the most efficient factory layout they could find. And there is some, how should I say, irony that even though right now for us it's quite obvious that there was this massive technology transfer at that time, and I'm talking about the years before Pearl Harbor, there were still a lot of U.S. stereotypes of Japanese backwardness and derivative engineering. And I'm looking into the files of the US intelligence. In many ways, they widely underestimated the fast progress of Japanese aviation. The thing becomes even more interesting. There were several record flights in Japan for long distance and for flight time. And the Japanese were so proud about those records that they widely published it. There was even around the world flight of a Japanese aircraft visiting the United States. But this did not have a large effect on the American military to reevaluate Japan's air power. So as a result, the performance of Japan's latest fighters and bombers and also the dramatic production increase of Japan's aircraft industry before the Pearl Harbor attack was grossly underestimated.
But nonetheless, that technology does get cut off with the advent of the war. So Japan, when in terms of their transnational development, they have to look elsewhere. During the war, to whom did they turn and what are they looking for specifically and how do they go about getting it?
Yeah, so during the war, technology is cut off, which, by the way, in the months before Pearl Harbor, really created like a ticking clock scenario. So there were still missions going to US and trying to buy up everything they could get. But of course, they stopped with the embargo. And then, again, of course, there were not many candidates left. And of course, now Germany comes back into the game again. And this would be in the chapter about, where I write about jet and rocket technology. And why would jet and rocket technology be important? When the war turned against Japan, the military pressed the nation's aviation manufacturers for increasingly radical designs. And such a radical new engine type would be, for one hand, the jet engine, and on the other hand, the rocket engine. And now there is an argument by many, the Japanese turned to the Germans, but, they just copied it and that's it. And I'm just arguing the other way around. I say that it was precisely the scarcity of German material that spurred the creativity of Japanese engineers to come up with their own original design solutions. So the Japanese only had at hand very basic information, and they had to solve a number of challenging problems to come up with working prototypes. I also describe how this development had to cope with dwindling resources and the constant threat of death-dealing air raids. And again, I will say, as a tribute to the ingenuity of the Japanese engineers, I describe that, the Japanese made it. Just a few weeks before Japan's final surrender, the engineers presented two working engine prototypes, one the rocket engine and jet engines. And again, as one of history's, sad ironies, there was the successful maiden flight of Japan's first jet aircraft, the Kika, and that happened on August 7, 1945, one day after the Hiroshima bombing. Now, why do I think that this flight, even it had no military significance at all, why do I think that's quite remarkable? I think it's remarkable because at that time, the Americans did not have a single jet aircraft in operational use. And therefore, the Kika, the jet engine-driven aircraft, is another example that aviation technology in Japan had once more overtaken that of their wartime enemies.
And as you explain, it's done primarily through their indigenous development. I was really struck by the story that you tell about when the Germans are engaged in this technology transfer. You describe how the Germans, it seems almost half-hearted. They send a manual that consists mostly of pictures. They send one diagram of the jet engine that they're using, and with no real they don't even explain what the various things are in it. It's just basically the diagram without any instructions. And yet you describe how as soon as the Japanese engineers see this unlabeled diagram, they can instantly interpret it and they realize what they can borrow from it that would improve their already advanced design.
Yep, that's right. I describe this maybe a bit of drama when the engineers first saw just one single diagram. It was like a satori, like an enlightenment moment to them, because they instantly understood the new features of this design, and they could, within a very short time, apply these ideas to their own design. And talking about Germany and cooperation, wartime cooperation, well, it's well known this was, not a smooth affair. In many ways, the Germans were reluctant to give away the latest technology. And it's also important to consider that at that time, the only, safe way of transport were submarines because of the Allied blockade. And there was indeed a submarine bringing a jet aircraft to Japan. But that submarine was sunk. Another submarine had a few blueprints on board that finally made it to Japan. But once more, I'm mentioning this to support my argument that even with such a very limited information available, the Japanese, they built working jet and rocket engines.
Now, the end of the war is hugely disruptive to the Japanese aviation industry. How does it develop in the post-war period, and what elements, does it retain a transnational element? Does that transnational element get reduced, or is it in some ways expanded?
Yeah, so the transnational element is still there, and it's quite interesting that in many ways, the development of Japan's post-war aviation was a replay of its pre-1945 history. And so I identify some what I call trans-war legacies. For instance, after the war, and I have to be more precise, after 1952, when the Japanese finally were allowed to build aircraft again, there was a fear of technological backwardness and dependency. So again, there was this drive for an autonomous aviation industry. Again, the military after the war strove to include the public in its aviation project. For instance, there were a large number of spectacular flight shows that attracted huge crowds. And again, I will say after the war, the country's leadership deftly grasped the opportunities of a new post-war international order to build Japan's air power. Simply, with the Cold War emerging, the politicians and leaders, they could rely on U.S. Support, and which made the U.S. quite a willing partner to share the latest technology, and this gave a big boost to the post-war aviation industry in Japan.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about this. So I have a new book in mind. The working title would be Pilots for the Rising Sun. And this would be a look at the history of pilot training in Japan. So there are several interesting aspects. I want to explore Japan's youth aviation education. I want to look into how the government and the military instilled air-mindedness into the young Japanese. So by doing this, I also want to cover the development of military and civil flight training. And one aspect I want to devote special attention to is the training of young kamikaze pilots. a topic that, in my view, has received a rather biased treatment so far.
Well, I think that is a book that's going to have a ready audience when it comes out, and I hope that when you complete it and publish it, that we can have you back on the New Books Network.
That would be great. I will be happy to talk about the next book then.
Jürgen Meltzer, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Same to you. And once more, thank you for giving me this opportunity.